instead to picture our Lord. Instead of seeing Eva, you should see our Lord. Our Lord was a Jew too, Angelo. The Monsignor's voice was pleading, trying to redirect his focus to a safer place. Yes, he was. And if he were on Earth today, the Germans would arrest him, too. They would arrest his mother. They would arrest the apostles. They would load them all aboard a northbound train, traveling for days without a place to sit. They would make them stand in their waste, no water, no food. And when they finally arrived at their destination, they would work them to death or gas them immediately. Angelo. The Monsignor was aghast at Angelo's crass response. Angelo almost laughed out loud at his horrified expression. But he didn't laugh. He didn't cover his head and cry either, which was what he wanted to do. It was crass, but it was true. Funny how that worked. Here is the difference, Monsignor. Jesus gave himself willingly. He could have saved himself, but he was God, and he chose. Eva is just a girl. She wasn't given a choice. The Jewish people have been stripped of choice. They have been stripped of liberty. They have been stripped of dignity. And they cannot save themselves. Throughout the next day, Angelo watched the military college where the Jews gathered in the roundup were being held. It was close enough to the Vatican that he could see portions of the courtyard from the window in Monsignor Luciano's office. He arranged for food to be delivered to the prisoners, as much as he could gather and cobble together with permission from his higher-ups. The soldiers made them leave it in the courtyard. He wasn't certain anyone inside received any of it. There was little movement. German soldiers with submachine guns guarded the facility, and no one left. But in the early morning hours of October 18th, 48 hours after the raid began in the old ghetto, army trucks started leaving the Italian military college. When Angelo arrived at dawn, he managed to arrange for a Vatican car to follow the row of trucks at a distance. The trucks didn't go through the regular terminal, nor were the prisoners put aboard passenger trains. He and Monsignor O'Flaherty, the Irish senior official who had cleared the food delivery, watched as the trucks filed into the loading platform at Tiburtina station. Men, women, and children, many still in their pajamas, the clothes they were arrested in, were loaded into freight cars, packed in at full capacity with barely room to stand and no room to sit. The doors were shut and locked. The empty trucks left and returned again several times. All day they watched. Truck after truck arrived at the loading dock, and the process was repeated. The day was warm, but the cars were never reopened. The people inside never received water, and the cattle cars had no bathrooms. Angelo and Monsignor O'Flaherty could only watch from afar. A pair of cassocked spies sharing a set of binoculars. They couldn't hear the crying children or the questions that must have been raised among the crowded occupants of the trains, but they voiced some of their own. Why would the Germans want to transport all those people hundreds of miles just to kill them? And what reason would they have to kill them in the first place? It would be completely irrational. Surely they would be put to work. It was the only logical conclusion. But Angelo knew. He'd had a group of refugees from Czechoslovakia that had told him about the trains. And the evidence was in front of his eyes. The words he'd said to Monsignor Luciano in the early morning hours of the previous day were riveted in his head. They would load them all aboard a northbound train, traveling for days without a place to sit. They would make them stand in their waste, no water or food. And when they finally arrived at their destination, they would work them to death or gas them immediately. "Why won't the Pope do something?" Angelo cried, watching yet another transport arrive.
Can't he intercede? These are Rome's Jews. They were guaranteed this wouldn't happen, and it's happening. We are standing here doing nothing to save them.
Monsignor O'Flaherty put down the binoculars and rubbed at his tired face, crossing himself and muttering a quiet prayer before he turned to Angelo with wounded eyes.
I can't answer that, Angelo. All I know is that sometimes we only see our corner of hell. The Pope has to consider what intercession in one place will mean in every corner, to all people. If he starts making demands for these Jews, what will Hitler do? The line is so tenuous, Angelo. Lives hang in the balance of every decision. Many lives. More lives than these. The Church is hiding thousands of Jews and caring for people in every community throughout the world. We can't continue what we're doing if we draw a target on the Vatican walls. Now can we?
Angelo had no answer, and he could do little but watch as his corner of hell continued to widen. Finally, at 2 p.m., 8 hours after the first trucks arrived at the loading dock, the cargo train, pulling 20 freight cars filled with more than 1,200 of Rome's Jews, left Tiburtina station.
20 October, 1943. Confession. Uncle Felix was right about long notes. Uncle Felix used to torture me with long notes, the most tedious, painful, boring exercise known to violinists all over the world. One note sustained endlessly. No volume change, no variance, no vibrato. Babbo hated long notes almost as much as I did. The music room was on the other side of his library at the villa. One day I heard him heave a book at the wall after I'd been playing long notes for more than an hour. It ruined my concentration, and I stopped, falling just short of my record.
Uncle Felix shouted, "You will never master this instrument if you do not master the long note, Bathsheba."
I was so frustrated I yelled back, "And you will never master Italian if you speak only in German."
Babbo heard that too, and I was grounded for a week for my impertinence.
I play my long notes when I am alone in my room at the convent, and for the first time in my life, I am comforted by them. I am comforted by my ability to master that one continuous sound, though my arm aches and my spirit longs for music. Life is like a long note. It persists without variance, without wavering. There is no cessation in sound or pause in tempo. It continues on, and we must master it or it will master us. It mastered Uncle Felix, though one could argue that he simply laid down his bow. I wonder what the nuns think of this exercise, the long note that wails from my room night after night. I would think if anyone understood the power of constancy, it would be the nuns of Santa Cecilia. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 12. Via Tasso. 2 days after the raid, looters, realizing the city's Jews had been forced to leave their belongings behind when they were arrested, had moved into the ghetto and started taking anything and everything of value. In the darkness before dawn of the third day, Mario Sonnino and his little family walked the dark streets to the church of Santa Cecilia and rang the bell on the gate.
"Father Angelo told us to come here,"
Mario said when Mother Francesca peered at him through the iron bars.
"And Eva," the little girl chirped up. "Is Eva here?"
Mother Francesca took one look at the tired mother, an infant in her arms, and the two children holding their father's hands, and ushered them through the gates and up the stairs to the room next to Eva's. Eva came awake to the sounds of a baby crying and the padding of nuns' feet scurrying down the corridor, trying to make accommodations for the new arrivals. She jumped out of bed and dressed in the dark. Another bed was brought into the little room, and a crib was fashioned out of a large crate. Mario and Lorenzo would stay on the lower floor, where two other Jewish males were boarding. The nuns had rules about these things, but Mario could only nod gratefully. He'd had a plan in place, but it was too late to implement it.
The escape routes have closed. The Germans have shut down the port of Genoa, and the Swiss border is too dangerous. Julia and the children would not be able to make it, even if they weren't. It is too grueling a trip.
I don't know where to go, Eva. We have the false passes, but nowhere to live.
And my pass won't be sufficient to hide me.
I was worried about you. I should have come back to check on you myself. Angelo wouldn't hear of it. He said the ghetto was too dangerous.
Eva said, as she helped Julia unpack their small suitcases.
It was, but don't worry. Father Angelo came himself, and he told us to come here before the sun rose. It is the safest time to be on the streets. There was a family who offered to hide us, another doctor and former colleague of mine. But it is getting too dangerous. It's not just the Germans we have to look out for.
Eva knew what he meant. The Black Shirt Brigades, OVRA, the Organization for Vigilance and Repression of Anti-Fascism, and the Fascist House, all Italians, were reporting to the Gestapo. They were actively hunting Jews and spying on other Italians.
I didn't want to endanger his family.
Mario stopped suddenly and looked at the ground as if he were ashamed.
Yet we are here, endangering these women, he whispered brokenly.
You will be safe here, and so will the nuns, Eva replied firmly. It was the right choice.
In the days that followed, Angelo brought two young sisters, one 15 and one 16, who had escaped the razzia when their older brother had forced them out an upstairs window and told them to flee across the rooftops, promising them that he wouldn't be far behind. He'd been shot instead. An older couple and another young family with two little boys, not much older than Lorenzo, followed shortly thereafter. A pair of brothers in their early 20s and a man and his young daughter rounded out their numbers. The small convent was starting to burst at the seams with new boarders. It was illegal to take in boarders without legal documents, and only Eva and the Soninos had papers that wouldn't get them immediately arrested. It was also illegal not to list all boarders on an official register. But then again, at this point, it was illegal to be a Jew in Rome. Mother Francesca had fretted about their growing numbers and the official register that she had to produce if the police asked. Angelo had pulled her aside and reminded her how the mother Mary herself had been turned away time and time again and ended up giving birth to the savior of the world in a stable.
We can't turn them away, Mother. They have nowhere else to go.
Angelo also had letters from cardinals, asking all religious institutions to open their doors to refugees and do what they could to shelter them. And he used the letters without remorse or restraint. He'd told Eva that the pastors throughout the countryside around Rome had reminded their parishioners that Jesus was a Jew in order to coax them into opening their doors. Catholic guilt was a powerful tool, and Angelo and his brothers showed no qualms at wielding it. In the days that followed, Angelo and the abbess gave instruction in catechism and liturgy and taught lessons in paters and aves to the refugees, a crash course in Catholicism on which they were continually grilled. The refugees who had false papers and whose accents or appearance would not give them away went with Eva to the municipio to obtain food coupons and proper residence permits. Aldo was able to get forged documents to Mario Sonnino, consisting of release papers from the Italian army and a doctor's labor permit. He shouldn't flaunt it, but it would give him a measure of cover if he were discovered or detained. Even with some of the boarders able to register for ration cards, the number at the convent, the numbers at every convent and monastery throughout Rome, were far greater than the rations allotted. Mario knew where Levi had gone to buy items on the black market, and he and Angelo braved a few clandestine meetings to secure butter and milk, two things Giulia Sonnino desperately needed. She wasn't well, and she wasn't producing enough milk for her new baby. But Angelo was resourceful. 2 weeks after the raid on Rome's Jews, a woman in his old parish lost her baby in a house fire. Somehow, Angelo got wind of it and brought the poor mother to the nuns of Santa Cecilia, giving the woman a roof over her head and providing little Isacco Sonnino with a wet nurse. If there was a need, he found a way. His abilities as a goalie translating beautifully to his abilities as a wartime priest. Scramble, protect, defend. Angelo inspired the same ingenuity and respect among everyone he served, and he never stopped moving. He'd drawn some attention from the local Italian police, who had questioned him on more than one occasion, but he'd just blessed and genuflected his way out of trouble every time, doing as much business as he could from inside Vatican City, where the law of Rome could not touch him. But he was adamant where Eva was concerned. She would not risk herself. It was his one stipulation, until it was taken completely out of his hands. He sat on the long bench, slumped, his cap in his hands, a German officer alone, and people scurried past him. He seemed unaware of the discomfort he was causing, the fear and derision in the looks tossed his way. Eva had spent the morning in long ration lines, the one thing Angelo would allow her to do, and she had very little to show for it. She had brought Mario's violin with her that morning, instructed to barter with it if there was anything worth bartering for. There had been nothing. Now, several hours later, she was waiting for a streetcar to take her back across town. She still had 15 minutes to wait, at least, and she was tired, her feet hurt, and watching the big German occupy the whole bench suddenly filled her with a rage and an insolence her father would have trembled to see. She could almost hear his voice in her head, "Invisibility is our best weapon, Bathsheba." Invisibility may have worked for Camillo Rosselli, a thin, slightly stooped man of indeterminate years, but it didn't work especially well for a beautiful woman. Eva had learned that long ago. Her best weapon was to make others stare. Stare and assume she had every right to be exactly where she was. She sat down next to the man, her back stiff, her violin case in her lap. She perched with her nose in the air, reminding herself that he was the interloper, an unwelcome visitor to her country. He could move if she made him uncomfortable. He looked up in surprise. She felt him jerk, and she turned her head and eyed him in haughty rebellion before looking away. He continued to stare, his gaze heavy on her face. "Can you play?" he asked in German. Eva pretended not to understand. He signed. He leaned over and tapped the violin case. "Can you play?" he asked again. He mimed the action, and Eva noticed how tired he looked, how dark the hollows were beneath his eyes. She nodded once, a sharp inclination of her chin, and looked away again. "Play," he said simply, tapping at her case insistently. She shook her head. No, she would not play for him. He fell back dejectedly, and she thought that would be the end of it. "My father could play. He loved music. Beethoven and Mozart. Bach. He loved Bach." He was speaking so softly, Eva could have shut him out. But his voice broke on the last word, and his sorrow was palpable. Eva almost felt sorry for him,
Play, he demanded again, his voice rising. He leaned toward her aggressively and jerked the case from her hands. Eva instantly stood and stepped back. It was not her prized Stradivarius, but she wasn't foolish enough to grab it back, even if it had been. He set her case on the ground and opened it. He pulled the violin and bow free and stood, shoving them at her. She bobbled and almost dropped them, but he didn't care.
Play!
He yelled, his pale face suddenly ruddy with anger. A child started to cry, and Eva realized they were drawing attention. But no one stepped forward. No one intervened. Invisibility was the word of the day. She was too shocked to respond and stood staring at him, her bow extended like a sword.
Are you an idiot? Play!
He roared. Then he drew his pistol from the holster at his side and pointed it at her face. With a quick tightening of her bow and a hasty tuning of the strings, she lifted the violin to her shoulder and, turning her face from the unwavering pistol, notched it below her jaw. His father loved Bach. That is what he had said. Without looking at the German officer, Eva began to play Ave Maria, the version by Bach and Gounod, the one that had made her weep for her own mother and vow to master the violin if only to feel closer to her, to understand her. From the corner of her eye she saw the gun lower slightly, but only a bit, and Eva squeezed her eyes shut and concentrated on keeping the tone clear, the tremolo controlled, and the shaking in her legs where it wouldn't affect her performance. She had shunned invisibility. Look where that had gotten her. Now her only weapon was to play, and play well. The first sustained note was shy, hesitant. But Eva bore down, gripping the instrument fiercely, her chin pressed against the faded varnish like she was embracing a lover. The melody shimmered and strengthened, and before long she was coaxing a soaring aria from the singing strings that not even a trained soprano could match. Still, Eva heard it all as though she listened through a waterfall, her heart drowning out the sweet silvery slides and the quivering crescendos. And she wondered in the part of her brain that knew only thought, the part that watched as if from a safe distance, if this would be her final performance. She wondered if it was worthy of her uncle's sacrifice, her uncle's time, of all the hours she had spent practicing, hearing Babbo grumbling and Angelo begging for more. Then it was over. Complete. Eva lowered her bow from the strings and raised her eyes to her oppressor. He had dropped the gun to his side, and his face was streaked with tears. He carefully reholstered his pistol and turned away. He hesitated, his back to her. And Eva wondered if she would be asked for an encore. Her chest burned and she realized she needed to breathe. Without turning around, he said softly but distinctly,
Vergib mir.
Forgive me. He walked several steps, his spine stiff, his arms clasped behind his back. Then he resumed walking with a brisk determination, like he knew exactly where he was going. The streetcar was coming, the screech of the wheels on the track music to Eva's ears. The German officer headed toward it, as if he thought he could brandish his gun and make it stop, the way he'd pointed his gun and made her a play. As it neared, he quickened his steps, and with a composure that struck Eva as instantly familiar and terrifyingly predictable, he threw himself in front of the streetcar. The sound was hell unleashed. A shrieking, tearing, grinding groan, and the car bucked on the track, attempting to swallow the man whole and spewing him out again. People were screaming and pointing, and within seconds, minutes, a siren blared, then another, a cacophony of banshees in the bright blue day. Eva walked on wooden legs to the case that lay thrown open on the ground.
She carefully placed her violin inside, closed it, and sat heavily on the bench. She resumed waiting for a streetcar that was already there, a streetcar that wouldn't be taking her anywhere. Her hands shook and her stomach revolted, and every horrified breath felt like fire in her throat. Yet still, she sat, composed. Her terror held inside the bony cage that sheltered her war-torn heart and her shrapnel-ridden lungs. Then there were Germans with whistles and clubs, pushing onlookers into a cluster, yelling in a language no one seemed to understand. But Eva understood.
"Someone pushed him!" an officer shouted. "Who pushed him?"
The terrified crowd looked around, as if to find the culprit. And one woman pointed toward Eva as if to say, her.
"She was with him,"
the woman said in Italian.
"That woman with the violin, she was with him."
Several of the officers and a handful of horrified onlookers followed the woman's pointing finger to the bench where Eva sat. The Germans may not have understood what the woman said, but they understood her gesture. Eva rose from the bench, shaking her head.
"Nein," she said. "No, he was not pushed. He walked right in front of the streetcar. I watched him."
Her voice rang out in German, and two of the officers broke away and came toward her.
"What is your name?"
one barked, his hand on his gun.
"Eva,"
she answered numbly. She couldn't remember her last name for a moment. Then she remembered she wasn't supposed to say it, and was grateful for the shock that had stalled her tongue.
"Documents!"
He waited with an outstretched hand. She fumbled in her pocketbook, and rushed to set her fake pass in his hand. He looked at it for several seconds and handed it back.
"You will come with me?"
What? Why?"
she asked in Italian, and repeated the question in German.
10 civilians for every German. That is the Führer's rule. You saw what happened? Who should we take instead?"
"But he killed himself,"
Eva shot back.
"So you say. Come with me."
"He walked in front of the streetcar,"
Eva cried out, this time in Italian, her eyes on the onlookers, knowing someone had to have witnessed the suicide. The people stood huddled, frozen, eyes wide, mouths closed, and no one said a word.
"No one was even close to him,"
Eva pressed.
"He just stepped in front of it. Someone had to have seen the same thing I did."
Then one woman nodded. Then another took courage. And before long, several people were agreeing, adding their voices to Ava's claims. The German officer either didn't understand or he didn't care to. But he took Eva's arm and marched her toward a jeep parked haphazardly in the middle of the street. He snapped at two of the officers and shouted orders at several more, and Eva was shoved into the back of the army vehicle and taken away. Whisked off the street, easy as you please, and there was nothing she or anyone else could do about it. The German police had converted a row of buildings on Via Tasso into their headquarters. It was an odd choice, just a modest thoroughfare of apartments and schools that was bracketed on one end by a crumbling arch and the sanctuary of the Scala on the other. Red banners with large swastikas hung down the front of the largest structure, looking official and garish against the dull yellow exterior. Inside, it was a construction zone guarded by soldiers with machine guns. The Germans had been in Rome for less than 6 weeks, and by the looks of it, they were anticipating a long occupation. Walls had been torn down and reconfigured, offices sectioned off, and a long row of dark cells, rooms without toilets or beds, stretched down one corridor, and many of the cells were filled. Eva was deposited in a room that looked more like a closet, and locked in. It was so dark it took her eyes several minutes to adjust. She could hear an occasional cry or barked command, and she put her hands over her ears to block it all out. Then she focused on what she would say if given the opportunity. Her mind kept tripping back to the melancholy German in his last moments. She had hated him on sight. She'd hated him even more when he'd held his gun to her head. But then she'd seen his tears and felt his despair. She didn't hate him now. She couldn't. She understood him too well. "Forgive me," he'd said. She did forgive him, wholeheartedly, and she forgave her Uncle Felix as well. For 3 long years, she'd pushed all thoughts of him away. But there, in the dark, she could feel him with her. They left her in the closet-like room for hours. Eva had no way of tracking the time, but she desperately needed to go to the bathroom, and her throat was so dry it was sharp when she tried to swallow. When a soldier finally arrived and ushered her out, she was given a drink and allowed to use the bathroom, another dark closet with a bucket on the bare cement overflowing with waste, before being led up a flight of stairs into an office that made the lower floors look like a different planet. A uniformed German of medium height and compact build waited for her inside a large office beside a large mahogany desk, as if sitting were beneath him. His uniform was crisp, his manner brisk, his eyes were sharp and his tone was sharper. "I am Captain von Essen. What is your name, Fräulein?"
"Eva Bianco."
She'd been rehearsing her lines for hours.
"Why are you in Rome, Miss Bianco?"
"My brother is a priest at the Vatican. I came here to be closer to him and to find a job."
"What is your brother's name?"
"Angelo Bianco. He works for the Roman Curia."
"No job in Naples?"
She shook her head.
"No."
"You speak German very well, but you sound Austrian."
She nodded.
"Surely you didn't learn to speak German so well in school."
"I learned in school, but I had a music teacher who was Austrian."
"Is that so?"
"Yes."
"What kind of music?"
"He taught me to play the violin. I spent a great deal of time with him."
"And where is your teacher now?"
"He is dead."
She thought he would ask for details, and he seemed to consider doing so, but changed tacks.
"A German soldier is dead, too. He was a very dedicated officer. I am having trouble believing he would just walk in front of a streetcar."
"But he did,"
Eva said quietly, firmly. He met her gaze and then lowered himself into his chair and steepled his fingers in contemplation.
"You did not push him?"
"No."
"And you didn't see anyone else push him?"
"No. No one pushed him. He seemed very upset."
"And how would you know this?"
"He held his gun to my head and demanded I play my violin for him,"
Eva said simply. Captain von Essen raised his furry blonde eyebrows and leaned forward.
"And did you?"
he asked.
"Yes."
"Show me."
He pointed toward the door. Her violin case had been set against the wall, just to the left of the entrance. It had been taken from her, along with her documents, when she'd arrived. She wondered why he was asking her questions he obviously already knew the answers to. She stood and retrieved the case, willing strength to her limbs. For the second time in one day, Eva was being ordered to perform, wound up tight like a jack-in-the-box and told to play for her release.
"Do you know any Wagner?"
the German asked curiously. Eva stiffened, hearing Felix's voice in her head.
"No, Wagner. He doesn't care much for Jews, so I don't care much for his compositions."
"Not well enough to play."
What a shame." "But there are so many wonderful German composers. Mozart, Chopin."
"Mozart is Austrian. Chopin, too,"
Eva corrected him. She knew she sounded belligerent and was pleased at her tone. She wasn't sure at what point she'd stopped being terrified. Maybe sitting in the dark with thoughts about suicide had tipped the balance.
But Austria no longer exists. You must know. Austria and Germany are one and the same,
he reasoned. Eva just nodded, not trusting herself to speak.
Play Chopin, he demanded.
Eva lifted the violin obediently. Shutting the captain out, she found the thread of music in her memory, the variation she'd played for Uncle Felix. Chopin mixed with Rosselli, sprinkled with Adler, and doused with anger.
Genug,
the captain said briskly. That's enough. The music didn't seem to impress him. Eva stopped immediately.
Others have verified your claim. It appears you have done nothing wrong. You are free to go.
He stood once more, as if it had all been a formality to begin with, as if the hours she'd spent locked in a 4x8 room were just an oversight. She stared at him stupidly, wondering if he was toying with her.
Can you type?
He asked abruptly. Eva stared at him blankly, trying to switch from Chopin to freedom to this new line of questioning.
Yes.
Her answer sounded more like a question, lifted on the end, confused.
I need a secretary who speaks German.
Eva could only sit in frozen horror.
You want me to work here?
Yes, here. We will compensate you well. You will run errands. You will file, you will type, you will get coffee. Nothing too difficult. No one will hold a gun to your head and demand for you to play your violin.
He didn't smile, though Eva was sure he was attempting to be humorous.
You said you needed a job,
he prodded.
Yes, yes, I do.
Her mind reeled with the horror and the possibilities.
Then it is settled. 6 days a week. You will have Sundays off. Be here Monday morning at 8. You will leave at 5. Your brother, the priest, is here. He's been waiting for you. You must tell him you were treated fairly.
It was not a suggestion. Eva could only stare in amazement once more. Angelo was there.
It is after curfew. We will have a car take you both home. You will report back on Monday.
He waited for her to stow her violin and then handed her her fake identity card. It had held up twice now. She would have to tell Aldo. He had a soldier escort her to the reception area, where two Germans with submachine guns were parked on both sides of the entrance, and two more behind a large desk. Angelo sat on a metal chair with his head bowed. His hat had been removed, and he held a cross in his hands. When she approached the bottom of the staircase, he raised his head half-heartedly, like he'd been lifting his head all day to disappointment. He shot to his feet, his eyes on her face, scouring her expression for duress. She tried to smile to put him at ease, but the twist of her lips felt strange, and the effort made her feel like weeping, so she gritted her teeth and let the soldier lead the way.
"There is a car out front,"
the young German said to Angelo.
"You will both be taken home. Please follow me."
He strode briskly for the door, expecting them to do as he said. Angelo took Eva's arm, clutching her so tightly she would have bruises. She welcomed his grip, though the irony that she would leave German headquarters bruised only by Angelo was not lost on her. Their armed escort held open the door of a shiny Volkswagen for them, waiting as they slid into the back seat. He leaned down, his gray turtle-shell helmet pointing toward them.
Address.
Angelo answered for both of them, supplying the address that Eva assumed was the apartment he shared with Monsignor Luciano and his sister. The German snapped his heels together and shut the door firmly. He relayed the directions to the driver, and seconds later the car pulled away from the curb. The streets were quiet. Romans hiding obediently in their homes, waiting for sunrise, when they could start the process all over again. She and Angelo didn't converse. The German at the wheel shot them a curious look in the rearview mirror, his eyes lingering on Eva and then flitting to Angelo before looking away. Angelo had released her arm when she'd climbed into the vehicle and he didn't take it up again.
"There was a woman hung from a street light today. A partisan," the driver said conversationally in German.
Neither Angelo nor Eva responded.
"She asked for last rites." "Were you aware, Father?"
he pressed. Angelo nodded once, but his hands balled into fists.
"When you said your sister had been brought in, Father, there was talk going around that the partisan was your sister. We don't have many women at headquarters. Not yet. Fortunately, I was wrong."
He commenced whistling like it was a truly happy occurrence. With the streets bare, the ride took a quarter of the time. And before long, Eva and Angelo were stepping out onto the dark sidewalk in front of a building Eva didn't recognize, and watching the black Volkswagen pull away.
10 November, 1943. Confession. I never used to pray. Prayer wasn't something I ever thought about when I was younger. It wasn't something that mattered to my father, and so it didn't matter to me. Then one day, it did matter. So I started to listen, and I started to pray. The prayers of the Jewish people have been passed down, generation after generation, and when I say the prayers, they are like lullabies. In the prayers I feel my parents, and their parents, and their parents before them. I feel them all singing to me, and they are not gone, but just away. We are apart, but not forever. So I will keep saying the prayers. I will never stop. And because of this, I will always be a Jew. Angelo does not pray the way I do. He calls his God a different name. But I'm convinced God is not just my God or Angelo's God. He is God. He wouldn't be God if he was only God to some of his children. Would he? Whether or not his children call him by the same name, I call my father Babbo. Angelo refers to his father as Papa. Does it matter what we call him? Does it matter how we pray, if our devotion is pure, if our love for him leads us to love and serve and forgive and be better? I guess it does. Sadly, it does. Because my prayers could get me killed. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 13. The Church of the Sacred Heart. "Come with me," Angelo said softly. He turned, not taking her hand, not holding her arm. He acted as if the buildings had eyes. He walked swiftly, his cane clicking on the cobblestones, and turned up a narrow alley. He walked in the shadows along the back of the building until he reached the rear entrance of a large church surrounded by a high wall. Eva realized belatedly that this was the Church of the Sacred Heart. They'd just approached it from another direction. Angelo groped beneath his stiff white collar and pulled up a chain that was hanging around his neck. Several keys hung from the links, and he selected one and unlocked the gate. It opened soundlessly, as if the hinges were kept well-oiled. He closed it behind him, a careful clang, and led Eva up a little path that ended at the back door of the church. With another key, he unlocked the rear entrance, and they slipped inside. The scent of incense and candle wax assailed her, and beneath that heavy fragrance, the smell of old stone and damp corners. Vespers was over, and the minimal lighting from the wall sconces was mellow and muted. Angelo genuflected before the cross and slid into a pew, indicating that Eva should sit as well.
"Why are we here?"
She had known Angelo wasn't taking her to the convent when he gave the German soldier a strange address. But she'd thought he was taking her to his home.
I didn't know where else to take you. There is nowhere else where I can speak freely.
You don't trust Monsignor Luciano and his sister?
I trust them. I just don't want to endanger them. And every time I turn around, there is a new threat.
He clasped his hands and rested them on the back of the pew in front of them.
What happened today, Eva?
I saw a man die. A German soldier. He killed himself. Just like Uncle Felix. I was waiting for the streetcar. He held a gun to my head.
Mio Dio,
he moaned, and he dropped his head to his forearms.
He held a gun to my head, Angelo, she repeated. And he told me to play my violin, so I did.
The whole bizarre incident felt like a Greek tragedy, acted out by unfamiliar actors on a makeshift stage.
When I was done, he asked me to forgive him. Then he walked away.
How did he die? Angelo asked.
He threw himself in front of the streetcar. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Eva pressed her hands into her eyes, wondering how she would ever forget what she'd seen, forget what it had sounded like.
Then there were people screaming, and I just sat there. Before I knew it, I was being taken away. I told the soldiers what happened, but they didn't believe me.
They believed you. You wouldn't be alive if they hadn't. You would be swinging from the street lamp with that poor girl they hung today.
Angelo stared at her gravely, his blue eyes gray in the flickering shadows.
Who was she?
Part of the resistance. A partisan. She was even younger than you, and she was murdered in the street.
He looked away and scrubbed at his face with open palms, and Eva knew she wasn't the only one scarred by the day.
How did you know I was there, Angelo?
She asked, her eyes on the blue-robed virgin who looked at them from her corner perch with patient acceptance.
One of the nuns from Santa Cecilia was in the ration line, and she saw them take you away. She came to the Vatican and found me.
He rubbed his hands over his head once more, and his throat moved convulsively.
I have never been so scared in my life, Eva,
he whispered.
I have,
she replied softly.
Several times.
He looked up at her, and he didn't look away for several seconds. He just looked at her, drank her in, and she held his gaze.
I was offered a job, Angelo.
What?
He gasped, the spell between them broken.
The captain who questioned me, Captain von Essen. He needs a secretary who speaks German.
Eva pointed at herself.
I do.
Eva, mio Dio.
Angelo was shaking his head again. No, you can't do it.
I have to. What possible reason would I have to refuse? The convent needs the money.
No. You will hide. When you don't show up, he will find someone else. He doesn't know where you live. He won't be able to find you.
But he can find you, Angelo. He knows where you work. He knows who you are.
I will be fine, he snapped.
No, you won't. And I am going to take the job. Maybe I can help in some way. I will be in a position to hear if there is going to be a raid. Eva!
Angelo grabbed her shoulders and shook her so hard her teeth rattled.
This is madness. No, it isn't. It's war, and I will do my part. I will not sit by while others die. If I can help, I will.
Your job is to stay alive,
he cried, still gripping her by the shoulders, his face inches from hers. He was furious, but under the fury was a desperation she recognized. It was the desperation she felt when her father told her he was going to Austria to find her grandfather. But she understood her father now like she never had before. He had been compelled to act. Action was life, even if it ended in death.
No, Angelo. My job is not to simply stay alive. My job is to live. Not hide. Not wait. Not hope that it will all end. You can't tell me not to fight, Angelo. I don't tell you what to do. You can't tell me not to try to help in some way.
Eva.
If I can't fight, then I might as well swallow a bullet like Uncle Felix, or throw myself in front of a streetcar like that German soldier. I am this close to hopeless, Angelo.
She held her fingers an inch apart.
Resistance is all I have left. Don't you understand?
He looked down into her face, wanting to comfort her, wanting to comfort himself, needing to save her, needing to save himself.
Resistance.
He repeated the word like it was his own, and dropped his forehead to hers, closing his eyes and willing himself to move away.
Resistance,
he said again.
I do understand, he said softly. I understand completely.
His own resistance was shot, and he released Eva's shoulders and pushed himself up from the pew.
I don't want you to walk in the dark. It's after curfew, and it's too far. Can you stay here tonight?
He asked Eva tiredly. He looked at her long enough to see her nod. Then he walked away. But he didn't leave the church. He approached the altar, lit a candle, and used his cane to sink down to his knees in front of the cross. He buried his face in his hands, and for several long minutes he prayed. He didn't know if Eva watched, or if she'd retreated to the little basement room that she'd used once before, leaving him alone. All he knew was that his resistance was failing him, and he had no armor against her any longer. He started with his face in his hands. It was the way he always prayed, the way he'd been taught to pray. It kept him from sight and distraction, cradling his face that way, as if he covered himself from everything but the words he spoke. But before long, he was overcome, and he found himself prostrate, the way he'd lain during his ordination, his arms extended in front of him toward the wooden cross that hung above the altar. He was just a man, young, crippled, scared. But he would give his life for Eva. And he would give his life for the people he was trying to save. That had to count for something. It had to. He'd broken a promise. He'd held Eva in his arms, and he'd knowingly, willingly broken his vow. He'd kissed her. Yes, he'd been vulnerable. Yes, he'd been scared. Yes, it was forgivable. Even understandable. But there is a consequence for every broken promise. And he feared the consequence would be an innocent life. Not his life, but someone depending on him.
Please don't let my weakness be reason to withdraw from me. Please don't let my love for Eva endanger her or remove her from thy grace.
He said without sound, his lips moving around the silent words. That was what he feared most. That his own sin would cause a cessation of blessings, of divine intervention. And he could not risk it. There were too many people counting on him. When he'd gone to see Monsignor Luciano before he was ordained, the Monsignor had read him the account of David and Bathsheba in the Bible, and the name Bathsheba had not escaped him, essentially the same name as Eva's. At the time, it had struck him how King David hadn't averted his eyes as Bathsheba bathed. He hadn't looked away from her beauty, shielded her from his gaze. He hadn't stayed away, not after he'd discovered she was married, not after he'd realized who she was married to, loyal Uriah, who had faithfully fought for his king and country, not after he'd gotten her pregnant and created a mess. Not after he'd had Uriah put in death's path. He'd persisted in his sins, making them worse every step of the way. Was Angelo doing the same thing? Persisting in his sins by being near Eva? Was he willfully looking at her beauty and not averting his eyes when he should? The problem was, he didn't know how to stay away from Ava. He didn't feel like it was a choice. She was not another man's wife, another man's responsibility. She was his responsibility. He'd made a vow to God, but he'd made a promise to Camillo. And Ava was his. She had been his from the moment they met.
Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence, or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, so that sinners will turn back to you.
He recited David's prayer like it was his own, and when he finally finished and rose to his knees, he raised his head, his eyes seeking the candle he'd lit and the cross above it. A candle and a cross, the only thing that separated him from being hopelessly lost. But there were several candles now, and Ava sat nearby, her head bowed in her own prayer. He didn't disturb her, but watched as she prayed, her hands outstretched toward the candles she'd lit. When she raised her head and saw him watching her, she curled her fingers and stared down at her palms.
"What are you doing?" he asked softly.
"It's Shabbat,"
he nodded. She was saying her prayers beneath a cross. If it didn't bother her, it certainly didn't bother him. She continued speaking, her eyes on her bent fingers.
"With our hands we reach for things we shouldn't have, and we grasp what isn't ours. The way I have always reached for you."
She raised her eyes then and looked at him steadily.
"The way I have always reached for you."
Angelo's pulse quickened immediately, but he didn't look away.
"We reach for things we shouldn't have, and we grasp what isn't ours."
Her eyes returned to her hands, and she traced one finger over the opposite palm as she spoke, as if she were anointing it the way the bishop had anointed Angelo's hands at his ordination.
"With our fingers we touch the filth that is all around us. Our fingernails collect dirt. The lines in our palms become stained and soiled. Yet when we raise our hands in prayer or supplication, we demonstrate that even that which is sullied by the world can commune with the Spirit. That is why, during Shabbat, when we hold our hands toward the candle, we curl our fingers away from the flame, allowing the light to be reflected in our fingernails. Even our fingernails, the part of us that is most unclean, can still reflect God's light. At least, that's how I understand it."
She smiled ruefully and let her hands drop to her lap, but her eyes stayed fixed on the candlelight. Angelo raised his hands the way she had done, palms up, curling his fingers toward his chest, so he could see the light reflecting in his nails. He would never have the hands of a scholar, though he supposed he qualified as one. They were large and rough. They looked as if they belonged to a peasant, not a priest. They were his father's hands, he realized suddenly, the memory rising from somewhere in his past. His papa was wrong. He could have been a blacksmith instead of a priest. He had the hands to prove it.
"Fire purifies,"
he said softly, looking at the dirt on his palms. The floor in front of the cross obviously needed a good scrubbing. Ava nodded.
"When we wash our hands and say a blessing in the morning, we pour the water with our right hand over our left, which signifies kindness before might. When we wash, we are also remembering the close of Shabbat and the flame or power that purifies."
He shifted his raised palms, so they were no longer tipped toward the candle, but tipped toward her.
"I keep reaching for you too, Ava," he confessed. "I keep trying to grasp what isn't mine."
He dropped his hands and tried to rise, his bad leg making him awkward and clumsy, and his exhaustion.